there's always so much confusion about what time it actually is in Arizona because, you know, we don't do the whole daylight savings time thing.
Wait, I actually didn't know that. You just skip daylight saving time?
Yeah, we just don't do it. So it's like,
what?
We're either 2 hours behind the east.
You can do that?
Apparently, we're Arizona. We can do anything.
Welcome to The Campaign Moment. It's Friday, April 12th. I'm Martine Powers, co-host of Post Reports, and I am joined here with fellow host of The Campaign Moment, Aaron Blake, senior political reporter at The Post, and also the writer of The Campaign Moment newsletter.
Thanks for having me. And today we are so lucky to be joined by Yvonne Winjet Sanchez, who is a democracy reporter here at The Post and an expert on all things Arizona, which is very relevant this week.
So happy to be here. Big fan of the show.
So, Aaron, just lay out for us, like, what are we going to be talking about this week?
Yeah, so this is the week that abortion politics, which, of course, have loomed for a long time in our country, ever since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, really kind of came to the forefront because of some developments in key states that, with the Supreme Court's enacting very strict bans that have kind of forced politicians to take sides and potentially roll back these bans and basically made sure that this is going to be an issue that is going to be very relevant in the 2024 election.
And this very much seems like the campaign moment of the week, though I will say that we're going to also talk this week about intrigue in the RFK Jr. campaign. We're going to talk about what we can expect from the Trump hush money trial that starts next week. But just to dig in here to Arizona, Yvonne, I want to hear from you, like, what has gotten Arizona to this moment? Because I think a lot of us around the country saw the news this week that a court has ruled to allow a law from 1864 to go into effect that will now essentially ban abortion in the state. Like, tell me, where did this come from and how did Arizona get to this point?
Right. So the state Supreme Court, which is, you know, largely the result of made up of justices who reflect, you know, Republican governors over the past couple of decades, that court essentially cleared the way for enforcement of this law, which was created long before Arizona even became a state. And it essentially criminalizes abortion throughout pregnancy unless a woman's life is at risk. And there really are no exceptions other than that. And everyone, I think, was caught flat-footed about what the court would do in this case. I think there was a lot of assumptions. There were a lot of assumptions that they would say that the 15-week ban, which was the most recently enacted law, was actually the law that would take effect. And that was the one that the court would allow to stand. The exact opposite happened. And so while Republicans thought that they were going to have a lot of cover and that they were going to follow the law and they were going to do what the court said, they were just caught completely flat-footed and are now struggling to find a way out of the wilderness on this issue. Essentially, what this means is, you know, this ancient law is going to take effect within the next several weeks. Planned Parenthood has actually pegged it closer to 60 days or so, if nothing else happens. And for all intents and purposes, you know, women, pregnant individuals are going to have to go elsewhere if they are seeking those sorts of services.
You said that politicians were caught flat-footed at this ruling and how to respond to it. Obviously, this is a moment where Democrats are up in arms about this and the fact that, you know, women in Arizona are not going to have access to reproductive care in the way that they at least partially had before. But I want to hear more about why Republicans were, as you say, flat-footed here, or like why this is putting Republicans in a complicated position. Because I think the assumption is conservative lawmakers in Arizona would want to have an abortion ban in place. So, like, isn't this good for them?
Some Republicans would like to keep that in place. Republicans who want to win in a state like Arizona in key congressional races or statewide races, like the race for U.S. Senate, they understand the realities and the complications of a law this old, which does not reflect the will of the broader electorate here in Arizona. You have to remember that in a place like Arizona, especially in Maricopa County, which is the most populous county in the state, there are a lot of free-thinking, independent-minded voters, even staunch Republican conservative women voters and male voters, people of faith, people with means, people who have grown up in a country where you had a choice. They do not like being told that they no longer have a choice. They would like to maintain the status quo or at least have an option to think for themselves and to make their own decisions and to exercise the free will that, you know, God has given them. And that's really, I think, what it comes down to. And a lot of these Republican lawmakers, especially at the state legislature, who are trying to figure out now what they're going to do, they understand that. They know, especially in the cities that sort of circle Phoenix, those suburban areas, they know that this is not going to play well for them, and they very well could lose control of both chambers of the state house as a result of this.
Yeah, I think that this is probably more than any other moment in the post-Roe era, the moment in which Republicans kind of caught the car on abortion. Mm-hmm. When the Supreme Court overturned Roe, it opened this up to various restrictions, and then Republicans had to decide what they want to do with that. The 1864 law is something that was advocated for by the 2022 Republican Senate candidate, Blake Masters. It was something that was advocated for by the 2022 gubernatorial nominee, Carrie Lake. The leaders of the state House and the state Senate filed briefs in this case pushing for the 1864 law to be operable. And now, you know, not everybody has totally backed away from that. But they realize that this thing that they've been pushing for is suddenly a significant liability for them. And that is a microcosm of this larger situation in which Republicans now have the power to do this thing that they've been pushing for decades. And it turns out the things that they want to do with this are broadly unpopular. A lot of states have 6-week abortion bans. More than 60% of Americans oppose that. This law in Arizona bans abortion without exceptions for rape and incest. That's something that north of 80% of Americans oppose. Mm-hmm. The law in Arizona gives a 2 to 5 year prison sentence for abortion providers. About 3/4 of Americans oppose that. And so it reinforces how the 2022 Supreme Court decision opened up Pandora's box here. And Republicans have a lot of people in their party that truly want to ban abortion in every case. They want to punish providers. But that's not where the American people are. And so we've seen this kind of gradual acknowledgement of that fact. And a lot of these Republicans who kind of push for Roe to be overturned have gone in the other direction because they realize that the effect of that, the things that they're actually able to do aren't what the American people are looking for.
Yeah, I found it notable that we were basically having the same conversation about this last week in Florida, that you had this similar set of circumstances play out where a state court makes a ruling that allows a law to go forward, that it bans abortion, and now there's this question of, like, not only is this going to have backlash for Republicans who are running, but also there might be a ballot question. And like, what would that mean for turnout in these swing states? But what I don't understand in the Arizona situation is, like, well, if even Republicans are like, oh, this might not be good for us, like, can't they just repeal this law? Like, don't they have the power to decide, actually, we're just going to stick with the 15-week ban and, like, forget about this ban from 1864?
Oh, yeah, they tried that this week. There were a few Republicans who were willing to sort of put it all on the line and go up against social conservatives who wield a tremendous amount of power down at the state house. And their efforts failed. And they slinked back into their caucus rooms and tried to figure out what their next move was. And instead of reconvening and trying to take this up and get it resolved and behind them, they decided to go, you know, on a fundraising junket to Kentucky and try to reconvene perhaps this next week. They're adjourned until next week. We do expect them to come back maybe on Wednesday and try to take another run at this. I mean, several Republicans from some of these key districts, they understand the implications, the electoral implications of this. And so I think they are going to make another run at it. But you do have very powerful social conservative figures here in Arizona who have also been huddling with Republicans, and they're trying to convince them to go in another direction.
Go in another direction, meaning like it's going to be okay. Like we'll still be able to win elections even if we have completely banned abortion in Arizona.
Absolutely. Or to perhaps refer something to the ballot that will compete with another ballot measure that is on its way to appearing on the November ballot that would enshrine the right to an abortion in the Constitution. And that way they could at least theoretically help energize their base, energize their voters, and give them a reason beyond President Trump, Carrie Lake, et cetera, to get out and vote.
And a key thing to remember in this, and this is true of many issues, but the thing that is best for the National Republican Party or even statewide candidates in a swing state like Arizona is not always the overriding concern of the lawmakers who matter the most. You know, these are lawmakers who may have a Republican primary that they want to run in. The State House Speaker, Ben Thoma, is one of those. He's running for Congress in a race against some very hardline anti-abortion Republicans. So, you know, is he going to allow a vote that is going to repeal this and have that potentially hurt him in that primary? You know, there are true believers in the party on this issue. You know, how are they going to respond to what would effectively be their own party allowing for the legalization? What would this, that's what this would effectively be to roll back this law, allowing for the legalization of at least some abortions. You know, the fact that Republicans are in that position where they would be actually doing that, I think kind of reinforces the political dilemmas here. And it's not an easy call for the Republican Party. Exactly how they're going to do this is very difficult. And it's another consequence of the post-Roe kind of political paradigm that we have.
I mean, the fact that you have Carrie Lake, who was the 2022 gubernatorial nominee, was expected to win that race, loses narrowly, and has been very clear that she has been supportive of the 1864 law. The fact that she is now lobbying state lawmakers to go another direction and to fight this. I mean, I think it says everything that you need to know. I mean, just her body language, Trump's body language, his comments about how lawmakers and the governor are going to fix this up real quick and it's going to get fixed up real soon. I think, first, that's not true. And secondly, they wish it was, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's sort of all we need to know. They understand how damaging this could be for Republicans.
I want to jump in there because you mentioned Trump's comments. And it was funny that we had this conversation, Aaron, with Isaac last week about, you know, when is Trump finally going to come out and sort of talk openly about like what he actually thinks about abortion and about total abortion bans. And then to his credit, we saw him make multiple statements about it this week, though I think whether this gives a clear sense of what Trump actually believes on abortion is kind of up in the air. But I think it's worth just like taking a listen to some of the statements that former President Trump made this week.
My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both. And whatever they decide must be the law of the land. In this case, the law of the state.
Do you think a doctor should be punished who perform abortions?
I'll let that be to the states. You know, everything we're doing now is states and states' rights.
Did Arizona go too far? Did Arizona go too far?
Yeah, they did, and that'll be straightened out. And as you know, it's all about states' rights. That'll be straightened out. And I'm sure that the governor and everybody else are going to bring it back into reason, and that'll be taken care of, I think, very quickly.
You know, the Democrats are reeling. The only issue they think they have is on abortion. And now all I say is the states are handling it and it's totally killed that issue. We'll take care of everything. We're going to make our country great again. Everybody's going to be happy.
The one thing I feel confident about is that everyone is going to be happy. So what do you guys hear in these comments and how Trump is approaching this moment?
I mean, you got the sense of what he's doing in that last comment here. Quote, and now all I say is the states are handling it and it's totally killed that issue. He is punting on this. He is trying to, you know, get rid of this issue by throwing a blanket over it and saying states' rights. The problem with that is all these states are going to have different approaches to this issue. Some of them are going to go a lot further than you want them to. And, you know, especially in a moment like this, the Republican Party needs some leadership on like what their principles on this issue is. How far is too far? And they're not getting that from Trump. He's basically just trying to keep this issue at arm's length in hopes that it doesn't hurt him. In one way, it's a very significant statement that the presidential nominee is acknowledging that he doesn't want to talk about this. In another way, it's problematic for the party because it doesn't allow them any guidance. It doesn't kind of give them a set of principles by which they're going to push forward on this issue. And that's going to create what we have now, which is a patchwork of laws, which in some cases are going to create a liability for the National Party. And so the idea that he's quote unquote killed that issue is very far from the truth. And to the extent he's not willing to do more on this issue, it's just going to continue to dog the party moving forward.
And how long is he going to be able to stay disciplined with that message, right? Mm-hmm. I suspect as the issue lingers and it is not resolved and it's not going to be fixed up real quickly, he's going to grow frustrated. It's going to dominate headlines in battleground states like Arizona for a really long time until it's resolved. And even then, through the election, I mean, the level of energy around this conversation is unlike anything we've seen really since 1070 with the immigration bill that was passed. It was the toughest in the country at the time back in like 2010. This is a seismic moment for the Republican and Democratic parties here in Arizona. And I think underestimating it by thinking it's going to be, you know, just fixed up real quickly is going to provide a lot of fodder for news stories.
And to your point, you know, the fact that he is kind of punting this to the states and being vague on where he stands, I just feel like it leaves so much opening for the continued questions around, sure, okay, you want the states to decide, but like you, sir, are a resident of the state of Florida. Like, do you believe in this ban that is now in place? And like, where do you stand on this ballot question that you presumably are going to be voting on in November? And that, you know, that like, it's just, you can just see how it's going to continue to spin out of control.
Yeah. And also consider what the kind of true believers on this issue are going to do. They're being tested right now because their party's presidential nominee is moving away from this issue. Mm-hmm. This is very important to a very significant portion of the conservative coalition.
And do they feel betrayed? I mean, that is my question. Yeah. Like, how are they reacting seeing the president turn around and be like, actually, I don't believe in like sweeping abortion bans when like that's why a lot of people voted for him?
If there's one person in the modern Republican movement who could kind of pull the party back from the extreme on abortion, it might be Trump, because he has that kind of impact on the party where it's less about the details and people just believe in him as a person and kind of whatever he says goes. But if you picked an issue on which certain portions of the conservative coalition feel so strongly on a principled level that this is such a vital issue, it might be the abortion issue. And so we're seeing these anti-abortion groups kind of dance around rebuking him on this. But to the extent he's going to push forward and basically undermine them by not pushing for harsh abortion bans, they're going to have to do something, because he is, you know, taking this issue away from them. He's moving this issue in a direction that is not good for them. And so to the extent they're just going to accept that, it's going to hurt their cause moving forward. And people feel very strongly about this issue.
And a lot of them will just pivot the conversation to what they do agree with him on, right? And how his judicial picks are like, really, that's more important and longer lasting, and the legacy of those picks that will continue to hold the line for them, not just on abortion, but on a lot of other issues. That's sort of where they want to take the conversation. Rather than criticize him, they will point out where they align.
Okay, so let's take a break there. Next up, we're going to talk about RFK Jr. and also the start next week of the Donald Trump hush money trial in New York. We'll be back in just a second.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Our big number is one. One episode per day, one story per episode, one really deep dive. At a time when the world is more complex than ever, On Point's daily dedicated conversation takes the time to make the world more intelligible. From the state of democracy, to AI, to the wonders of the natural world. That's On Point from WBUR, one podcast we think you should subscribe to.
So now we are going to turn to a lesser discussed presidential candidate, though still very important in this race, independent Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And there was a video that came out this week that gave some insights into what is happening in his campaign. Before we listen to the audio of this video, Aaron, can you just explain, like, what are we going to hear and who's going to be talking in it?
Yeah, so this is a now former RFK Jr. staffer named Rita Palma. She was giving these remarks, kind of a political strategy session, in which she laid out basically how Robert F. Kennedy Jr. could be helpful to Donald Trump's campaign.
The Kennedy voter and the Trump voter, the enemy, our mutual enemy is Biden. See, Bobby, right now, he's pulling from both sides. Right now, he's actually pulling a little bit more from Biden. If the Republicans accepted the fact that New York, Maryland, Illinois, California, New Jersey, Connecticut, most of the Northeast is going to go blue, why wouldn't we put our vote to Bobby and at least get rid of Biden and get those 28 electoral votes in New York to Bobby rather than to Biden, thereby reducing Biden's 270? And we all know how that works, right? 270 wins the election. If you don't get to 270, if nobody gets to 270, then Congress picks the president. So who are they going to pick? Who are they going to pick if it's a Republican Congress? They'll pick Trump. So we're rid of Biden either way. Does everybody follow that?
Yay.
Okay.
Wait, so Aaron, what is happening here? Like, what is she saying in this tape?
She's saying the quiet part out loud. I think it's worth noting that this is not like a high-ranking member of the RFK Jr. campaign. And this is apparently not a message that was sanctioned by the campaign. This woman has now been fired. But I think it really highlights the fact that this campaign is kind of teeming with Trump supporters who believe that funding and helping RFK Jr. get votes is going to take more from President Biden than from former President Trump. The donors who are behind this effort are largely Trump donors. And so the idea is obviously in the Trump campaign is elevating people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the other third party candidates in this race, in hopes of helping themselves in the general election. And there is some evidence that that is working. I think it's a very significant moment, though, because it highlights what's been kind of readily evident from, just beneath the surface. And I think it's going to inform the conversation about this moving forward.
I would say in a place like Arizona, where I think the last election with the margin between Biden and Trump was like 10,500, any fall off, any vote really does matter. And you do have a lot of people here who are taking a good look at some of these third-party people, RFK included. And these are people who are just disgusted by the age, the conduct, the gas prices, the, you know, images of the wide open border, as they call it here in Arizona. I think those people are going to decide Arizona in 2024.
But sure, in this tape, this is what a RFK Jr. staffer is saying, like, they want to happen or intend to happen. But, like, how much of that is really translating to the message that potential Biden voters are getting? Like, is RFK actually doing an effective job at attracting potential Biden voters more than attracting potential Trump voters?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. The first thing to say is that Kennedy's campaign has been a bit of a mess. He's done well in the polls, but I think a lot of that owes to his name. You know, obviously people know the Kennedy brand. His image is pretty good for somebody who people probably don't really know a lot about, but that, again, probably owes to people just associating him with the Kennedy brand. He is much more popular with Republicans than with Democrats, like a lot more popular.
Which theoretically was bad for Trump, right?
Yes, theoretically. The issue is, though, that there is less enthusiasm in the Democratic base for President Biden. To the extent voters are enthusiastic, it's largely a function of them wanting to vote against the other candidate, Donald Trump. And so it creates a situation where there are many more voters who are potentially able to be picked off or stay home or vote third party. And so that's why there is so much focus on this. Right now, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is pulling relatively evenly from the two candidates, despite being much more popular among Republicans. You factor in these more left-leaning third-party candidates like Cornel West and Jill Stein, and the third-party impact is hurting Biden more than Trump. I think this is going to change in certain ways. You know, the fact that Kennedy is more popular among Republicans could matter if Republican voters, for instance, are turned off by Trump's criminal cases or something else moving forward. So this is a very live issue. But I think that enthusiasm is really the key thing right now. And so there's just more of an opening for left-leaning voters to go in a different direction if they're not totally happy with Joe Biden as their alternative to Donald Trump.
It does seem very much like conservative-leaning voters really do like Kennedy. But if you're going to go all in on him, why not just go in on Trump?
Right.
You know, I mean, they rhetorically, they do sound so similar on a lot of different issues. Hmm. And I think we'll maybe learn more about what their appetite might be as we watch some of these criminal trials unfold, if we get to see them at all.
Well, let's talk about the one criminal trial that I think we are at this point, like, relatively confident we are going to see unfold. And that is the trial that starts on Monday in New York. This is the Stormy Daniels hush money trial, the, like, quote unquote, brunt of the litter trial. I feel like there are a lot of nicknames for this trial, but it is the one that has actually been scheduled and somewhat guaranteed to unfold before the election, which is why it's important. I think we refer to this trial in shorthand so much that it's easy to, like, forget what this is actually about, especially because I think, like, the Stormy Daniels news was, like, that feels very, you know, 2018, just a long time ago. But I think it's worth just laying out for people, like, remind us, what is this trial about and what are prosecutors going to try to prove that Donald Trump did wrong?
Yeah, so this is technically a hush money trial, but that's kind of minimizes the whole scale of what this is truly about. The judge in the case, I think, summarized it aptly this week in a jury instructions letter that he sent. He said, quote, "The allegations are in substance that Donald Trump falsified business records to conceal an agreement with others to unlawfully influence the 2016 presidential election," unquote.
And unpack that for a second. Like, when he's talking about, like, concealing information to try to influence an election, like, what is he referring to there?
So basically, the idea was that the Trump campaign did not want to have Stormy Daniels come forward with this allegation during the 2016 presidential race. And they concocted this was something that was spearheaded by then Trump lawyer Michael Cohen, a scheme to basically pay her $130,000. And where this gets off the rails is that this wasn't, you know, reported as a campaign finance contribution or expense. This was something that was paid out by Michael Cohen, and then Trump reimbursed him by calling them legal fees, which is problematic. And Michael Cohen has pleaded guilty to a campaign finance violation. The key issue here is, was this unlawfully influencing the 2016 election by keeping this payment a secret? Basically, were they covering something up and filing false business disclosures in the name of doing that? And so I think it is easy to minimize this as just being a hush money case or a falsifying business records case, when in fact it's about kind of trying to keep something hidden from the American people that conceivably could have impacted the results of what was a very close 2016 presidential race. And so I think that's something that we should all remember as this moves forward. And it seems to be something that the judge is inclined to make sure that people know that this case is about.
Yeah, I find that interesting then, because it is so easy to hear, like, Stormy Daniels and think, like, oh, this is a trial that's about, like, a sex scandal or an allegation that a man who went on to become president had an affair with a porn star. And, like, we can be curious about that in its own way, but making the case that this is actually about election integrity and that it is more in keeping with some of the other cases that we're going to see play out in the coming year or so of, like, circumstances in which Donald Trump is accused of trying to interfere with an election in one way or another.
Well, that's a really complicated storyline for a lot of voters to follow. And I think that's why you get so much fatigue about, oh, he's in trouble again, or he's in court again, or now they're doing this against him, and he says it isn't true. And it's hard to pay attention to all of this. And, you know, will any of it really matter? Or is it already sort of baked into the numbers that we're seeing on the presidential race? I don't know.
The thing that I come back to on this is that, as Martine mentioned, this is something that was big news a long time ago, 2018. But when it came to how people were consuming the news about it back then, they actually thought it was a pretty problematic thing. Even relative to the Russia investigation, this was something that the American people thought that Trump had done something either illegal or unethical, more so than the Russia investigation at that time. So this is something that can be kind of rekindled to the extent people start paying attention to it again. But it is more small bore than the other cases. You know, the other election subversion cases, the Georgia one and the federal one, are a much grander scale, much more serious potential consequences. The classified documents case involves national security and whether Trump jeopardized that. So getting people to care about this relative to those cases is going to be difficult. But at the same time, it's something that I think if, you know, to the extent people are paying attention to it, they could see something at least amiss, even if they don't necessarily think it's the worst thing in the world that this happened.
On that note, I think we are out of time, so let's call it an episode. Again, Yvonne Winjet Sanchez is a democracy reporter for The Post based in Arizona. Yvonne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Aaron Blake is a senior political reporter and author of the Campaign Moment newsletter. Of course, you can find the link to subscribe to his newsletter in our show notes and at postreports.com. Aaron, thank you for being here as always. And we will talk more next week about, I guess, a lot of these same things and how this all played out.
Thank you, Martine.
That's it for this week on The Campaign Moment. Thank you so much for listening. If you are tuning in via Post Reports, we'll keep bringing you these conversations on most Fridays, but you will also be able to hear more from Aaron and many of our other colleagues by also following the Campaign Moment show feed itself. So this is like a separate podcast where we're going to be dropping extra episodes, especially as campaign news picks up further into the year. So be sure to subscribe to the Campaign Moment podcast in whatever podcast app you use to listen. Today's episode was produced and mixed by Ted Muldoon and was edited by Maggie Penman. We also have the rest of the Post Reports team. Those folks include Renita Jablonski, Rena Flores, Lucy Perkins, Monica Campbell, Alana Gordon, Ariel Plotnick, Bishop Sand, Renny Sfornowski, Sabi Robinson, Emma Talkoff, Sean Carter, Peter Bresnan, Allison Michaels, and Alahe Azadi. I am Martine Powers. We'll be back on Monday with more stories from The Washington Post.
So there's a map of U.S. time zones going around, and this is like a whole meme. And the map shows, you know, Eastern time zone, Central time zone, Pacific time zone. Then we have Arizona, and it's one state. And the time zone is 1864.
There's a lot happening these days. But I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters, without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.